Thursday edition, Locked On NBA. David Locke along with Ben Golliver to run through last night's action, talk about the big picture leagues. Ben's the national NBA writer for the Washington Post. You can get Ben's weekly newsletter by going to his Twitter account at Ben Golliver and subscribe, following his pinned tweet, and then subscribing. It's great. Good weekly newsletter to find out what's going on around the NBA. But Ben, Thursday edition, and small ball is breaking the NBA. I'm not actually surprised by this. Talking to Mike D'Antoni and being around the Rockets a few times since they've made this move, I'm big into it. But Memphis over the last 15 games was the number four defensive team in the league, and they just allowed 140 points to the Rockets.
Yeah, I don't want to take anything away from Houston at all, because there's no question their offense is clicking in a way that it hasn't previously. But I do think this game says a little something about both teams. If you look at Memphis, they're on the last night of a tough four-game road trip. They go 0-4 on the trip out of the break with losses to Sacramento, both L.A. teams, and now Houston. I thought at long stretches of the games against the Lakers and the Clippers, I was at both of them, they looked like a shell of the team that we saw earlier in the season. I think that to a certain degree, opponents have started to figure them out. I do think a lot of the veteran teams are ramping it up here during the stretch run. And I think some of that early season mojo and magic that they had going has started to fizzle a little bit. And along the way, they also lost Jaren Jackson Jr. To a knee sprain as well, which didn't hurt anything. And I do think you have to look at their trade deadline moves as well. I mean, you know, parting with guys like Jay Crowder kind of shook things up for them as well. So I think that they were a vulnerable target, and then Houston just took care of them. I mean, big-time nights from both James Harden and Russell Westbrook, continuing a trend that we've seen. I mean, Westbrook, the number that jumps off the page to me, plus 37 in 34 minutes for him. I mean, that's just an astonishing number, and it tells you about the kind of mismatch potential that he creates. So all in all, I think if you're a Houston fan, you're feeling like your season's definitely back on track. You're feeling like the front office pushed the right button at the trade deadline. And I think you're starting to look ahead to, you know, which playoff matchups are potentially the most favorable for you. And you're sitting pretty, basically.
Memphis decided to go get Justice Winslow. Everyone gave them huge praise for that deal. They ate a bunch of contracts to get it done. I as we've talked about in previous podcasts, I'm not convinced that Justice Winslow is that good. At least, you know, he's got some defensive ability, but he hasn't shown a lot of things. Are they going to regret this in the sense that if it torpedoes this season and the run that they had?
I'm not sure they would go that far, but I do think they might just second-guess it a little bit. I think this team was ripe to come back to earth regardless. I mean, you look at the strength of schedule numbers. I think that they have, at this point, the most difficult remaining strength of schedule in the league. If not that, it's close. And so I think some of these losses were just natural, like it was going to catch up to them, and maybe their record was inflated to start. And also keep in mind, I mean, it's still a team that's under 500 right now, so it's not like they were performing like this top 10 team prior to the trade. I think ultimately playing for the future for them was the right way to do it. Trying to cash out whatever they possibly could on Andre Iguodala made sense. I think it was a logical decision. And to me, as a franchise, they're in no hurry, right? I mean, if you're building around John Moran and Jaren Jackson Jr., I think you're in great shape. And one thing I think about when I look at this squad is those two guys fit together so seamlessly, and they have such great chemistry and friendship. When I compare them to other young duos around the league, whether it's Karl Anthony Towns and D'Angelo Russell, whether it's like Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton, whoever else you might want to mention, I don't know, Trae Young, and whoever else, John Collins down there in Atlanta, I would take Memphis's duo over those guys. And maybe you would take Zion and Brandon Ingram over Memphis's duo, and I can understand that that argument. But you've got to have that Memphis duo right near the top of the league for the young core team. So that's it was a lower upside move than some people gave it credit for at the time.
He's Ben Golliver, Thursday edition. He joins me every single Thursday for Locked On NBA. Let's go back to the Rockets on this, though. Where are you on them? I'm in. I think they're going to go 24-4 to close the year. I think they're going to be like the two seed. I think they're impossible to prepare for in a short period of time during the regular season. I'm on board.
Well, I'll take it one step further. If I say that they're going to face the Clippers in the 2-3 matchup, are you ready to take Houston?
That is what's going to happen.
Ooh.
Am I ready to take I mean, if anyone can handle five out and defensively, it would be the Clippers, in that they have Patrick Beverley, Kawhi Leonard, Paul George, all willing to defend. They, if anyone could take advantage of them on the glass, it would be the Clippers because they have Montrezl Harrell. I don't think they'll be able to play Lou Williams in that series. I've said this before. I think they have a Lou Williams problem. It would be an interesting series. I'm not ready to take the Clippers. I'm not ready to take the Rockets because I don't know why I think this, and I can't figure out what it is, and maybe it's just talk, and I don't want to be that far out on – don't have enough guts to be that far out on the limb. But I, for some reason, think if you have seven games to prepare for them or you get used to playing them, that somehow you'll be able to play them better than teams are right now. But it's they play so much of a different game, switching one through five and then just attacking the way they attack, that in the regular season, it's uncomfortable for teams to play.
Well, I think that your response to that is actually really telling, because I think if we went back before the trade deadline and I gave you that choice, I'm pretty sure that you would have said the Clippers, and if you would take the Clippers in that series. And if you didn't, I would have called you nuts. I'm not willing to call you nuts now for that. I mean, I think it's a real conversation. I would still take the Clippers, though, in that matchup, personally. A part of the reason why is we finally got Paul George back in the lineup here recently, and the Clippers' defensive ceiling, when he's out there with Kawhi, it just goes to a different level. Their shared ability to lock down a ball handler and then also have length and quickness and intelligence on the backside of that perimeter, it just drives team nuts. And I think that you know, their ability to switch everything defensively does make them a really strong matchup for Houston. And, you know, trying to slow down guys like Westbrook and Harden. I also think over the course of a series, the way you're going to beat Houston is by trying to punish them on the other end, right? Like, they're going to score their points. So you've got to make them work as hard as possible defensively. You've got to pound them if you can. You don't want to get into too much isolation stuff and take yourself out of your own offense, but you've got to kind of make them feel it and make them really work defensively. And I think with the number of offensive weapons the Clippers have, you know, they're kind of in a position to do that. And they can also keep up in shootouts. I mean, they've had a number of games this year where they've gone and put up 140, 150 points. And I think that, frankly, they're still being slept on just because they haven't been very healthy this season. And they're starting to get back healthy now. So I would still put the Lakers and the Clippers in that top tier, with Houston charging fast into that second tier as well. You know, there's no question that I'm more optimistic on Houston's postseason chances than I was before the deadline. The other thing I'd mention, too, is, you know, they still really need Covington and Tucker to stay healthy. If one of those two guys gets hurt, anything as small as an ankle sprain, that's tough for them. I know Tucker's had fantastic health and availability, you know, throughout his tenure there. Covington has been a little bit spottier here and there, but I think that they're still thin at those spots, and that could be a potential weakness as you're starting to get deep into the playoffs.
My broadcast partner during the season, Ron Boone, longtime ABA, NBA legend, played 1,041 straight games, and if A.C. Green didn't steal it from him, would have the all-time consecutive record and probably should be thought of by the Hall of Fame more than just being nominated, considering he's the third all-time ABA leading scorer. Just a side note, he made he's only been in the league for 50 years, so when he speaks, I listen. He made an interesting comment about Houston. He said they use less energy than any team in the league. And he made it when they played the Lakers and blew the Lakers out in that game. And his point was that offensively, Harden and Westbrook are the ones using the energy, and defensively, they switch everything. So they're traveling so much less distance. So you know, no one else – I haven't heard anyone else say that. And that's a perspective I think you only get from someone who's been around the league and sees the league the way he does.
No question. I think, you know, to build on that, I mean, the team that has worn them down in the playoffs is Golden State, the team that is constantly trying to put movement and pressure into their offense, right? That's trying to wear you down. Houston's held up pretty well against almost everyone else they've played in the postseason. And not that they've beaten every single team. I mean, they fell to San Antonio one year and everything else. But the team that's really succeeded in grinding them down and wearing down Harden from an efficiency standpoint and kind of outlasting them late in deep series, it's always been Golden State. And so I think that's the model if you're a team like the Lakers or you're a team like the Clippers. Like, if you want to be able to beat these guys, you have to outlast them, you have to make them work, and you have to make them cover ground defensively constantly, possession after possession, game after game.
He's Ben Golliver. I'm David Locke. It is the Thursday edition of Locked On NBA. Rejecting the Screen's got a going ISO this week. Every Thursday they do long form. It's great stuff. Make sure you grab it. When you start your hiring process, you may have questions. Will you find good applicants to choose from? What about education experience? And how will you know you've made the right hire? Indeed is here to help. Millions of great candidates use Indeed every day to find their next opportunity. You can also post a job in minutes and use screener questions to help create your short list of applicants fast. Also add skills tests to your job posts so you can get a confident in your application's ability. That would be get confidence in your application's abilities, or to get confident in your applicant's abilities. Not what I said the first time. Their library of more than 50 skills tests ranges from industry-specific skills like accounting to general aptitude tests like critical thinking. Indeed gives you the smart tools to make hiring decisions quickly and to be confident that you're making the right hire for your team. So post your job today at Indeed.com/lockedon and get a free sponsored job upgrade on your first posting. That's Indeed.com/LockedOn. Terms and conditions, exclusions apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020. In the midst of that, our love affair with Houston, we of course did what everyone does, which is ignore the Nuggets. I think I just feel guilty every time we do that. They didn't play last night. There's no real reason to mention them. But I, you know, Denver's got as good a chance to be the 2 seed in the West as anyone. So I think my guilty conscience wants to mention them. Interesting kind of turnabouts in the West right now. Oklahoma City, sitting by the sidelines, is suddenly moving up the charts and has moved into fifth as the Utah Jazz and them are now tied. The Jazz have lost 4 in a row at home with their loss to Boston last night, and have trailed by 15 or more in the fourth quarter of all 4 of those games. Boston looked really good. Jason Tatum, holy smokes, Ben Golliver, he is bona fide.
Well, he's going on a world tour right now. This is like a concert tour, like when Dr. Dre used to go play the big stadiums, and Tatum's just going to every single building and giving everybody 30 points. I mean, I guess he gave the Lakers, what, 40-plus, you know, not too long ago. But he is in the zone, and he's starting to get the respect from other NBA players around the league. He's crossed that threshold where other guys are saying, you know what, this guy is the real deal. I mean, LeBron gave him the Instagram love after that Lakers game, which came down to basically the final play. You saw C.J. McCollum tweeting, you know, just about how Tatum's taking his game to another level. And really what it boils down to for me is, first of all, the repetitions, the usage. The ball is in his hands a lot more. He's not being, you know, kind of marginalized by Kyrie Irving like he was last year. And now he's fully flourishing at times without Kemba Walker. But it's also just the ferocity with which he's attacking the hoop. He always had the physical tools. The body was there. You know, basically since summer league, you know, and maybe even before that, but the mentality wasn't. And now the mentality is there. He trusts that he can get to his spot. He trusts that he can get to the rim, and he trusts that he can dunk over people and finish over people. Now, you love to see it because it doesn't always click for guys, and it really is for him right now. He's wedging his way into that All-NBA conversation. I'm not sure he's going to quite get there. It's going to be a real race, you know, for those last front court spots. Kind of no way around it. And I do think that he's kind of setting himself up when you're looking at, okay, which teams realistically can take down Milwaukee in the Eastern Conference. And we just saw Milwaukee smack Toronto, you know, without too much trouble. Philadelphia, to me, is completely imploding. I mean, Simmons is injured. Now Embiid is injured. I mean, we can almost write them off. Miami is starting to fade a little bit.
Starting to fade. Miami just lost to Cleveland and Minnesota on back-to-back nights and is 2-7 in their last 9.
Okay, fully fading then. Part of my language.
They've lost to the Hawks, the Cavaliers, and the Timberwolves in 3 of their last 4. Their only wins are against Golden State and Cleveland.
Right, so you could take them out of the conversation. So who's the last man standing? Who's really going to push Milwaukee? I guess it's Boston by default. And at this point, unless Tatum continues to play like this and is that closing guy in that type of matchup and is, you know, putting up 30 points a game, I'm not sure that they're really in that mix either. So to me, like, the whole conference almost hinges on Tatum. I think it's going to be a boat race for Milwaukee throughout the playoffs unless Tatum continues to play like this. And so I guess for the hope of, you know, postseason excitement through April and May, I think we should hope that this continues.
The Pascal Siakam-Jason Tatum matchup for 7 games could be pretty awesome.
For sure, both ways. I mean, every position has interesting matchups within that series, right? Basically, 1 through 5. That will be one of the best series, probably the most competitive series that we'll see in the Eastern Conference playoffs, for sure. I think at this point, I'm starting to buy into Tatum more and more. I'm sure I'm not alone on that front. But, you know, if we're starting to even have the conversation, like, who's the best guy or the most reliable guy in the Eastern Conference besides Giannis, or which player would you want from the Eastern Conference for the next 10 years? I mean, he's rocketed to the top of those lists.
He was super impressive against the Jazz, not only in just an incredible first-half duel with Donovan Mitchell, the two of them going back and forth. I think in the first half, Tatum finished with like 25, Donovan finished with 22. But I never thought he was stealing the game from his teammates. You know, he went 13 of 20, he had 11 rebounds. Last year it felt like Kyrie's turn, Tatum's turn. Jaylen Brown, wait a sec. Hey, I'm over here. It's my turn. Hayward wanted it. I never felt that tonight with Jason Tatum. I thought he just played the game naturally and occasionally went one-on-one, but he got the matchups he wanted. He got Niang. He got Bogdanovich. They went hunting. They got the matchups they wanted, and he just beat people.
No, I'm with you. I've always thought his problem was the opposite. Like, he wasn't selfish enough, or he wasn't able to impose himself enough. And I guess that's a natural development for a wing to get there. I think that, you know, the next step for him, of course, is going to be the playmaking stuff. I thought when the Lakers hard doubled him late in that game, he didn't respond particularly well. It wasn't like he panicked and freaked out, but he just didn't really know how to keep his own offense going in that situation. And it's tricky. I mean, guys like Steph Curry, Damian Lillard, James Harden, those guys have all had to learn how to do that kind of on the fly. And it was a tricky game because they didn't have Kemba Walker to kind of balance the floor when he was facing those double teams. But to me, Tatum refining himself as a playmaker, you know, improving his vision, and then understanding how to handle that extra defensive attention when it comes. Like, those are the next steps for him. But the fact that he's already made so much improvement as an NBA player, he still hasn't turned 22 yet. I mean, that's what gets you excited and kind of salivating, you know? It's just the youth factor and the poise factor put together.
He's also the player to me that represents where the league is and how much it's changed. And what I mean by that is, you know, I know it was 40 years ago that, you know, that Magic came in the league, so that was a while ago. But, I mean, this is a 6'8" guy comfortably, easily running pick and roll, snaking underneath the pick and roll, getting guys on his hip, playing that whole game at 6'8". And that's the new dynamic. Everyone wants to call it small ball. I'll just call it skill ball, because to have that kind of skill set and be able to handle the ball and play pick and roll, what's unique to me is the guys guarding him are not used to defending pick and roll. If you're guarding Russell Westbrook and you're a point guard, you're being hit by 70 picks a night. You're used to it. You know how to get over. You know what you're doing. If you're a small forward or a power forward and you're getting hit on a pick and roll with Jason Tatum, that's not what you're used to defending. And it makes him makes that 6'8", 6'9" ball handler even more valuable.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase I always use is total basketball. Can you dribble, pass, shoot, think, and play defense? And to me, he checks all those boxes. The only real improvement area I could see is the playmaking side, you know, the vision side. I think that that's the next step for him. But he checks every other box, including defensively. The guy works really hard. He's long. He's got the frame. He's got good footwork. He's disciplined. He's smart. You know, he doesn't break schemes, you know, hunting stats. I mean, he kind of just is a good fundamental player on that end, and he's in a good system surrounded by, you know, smart and intelligent defenders there in Boston too. So, I mean, to be honest, he's the type of guy we've already been raving for 5 minutes about him. We could probably go another 10 minutes if we really wanted to.
But then Luka says, hey, excuse me, I had 26, 10, and 14 again tonight. Dallas beat San Antonio 109 to 103. Let's not let that become commonplace when Luka does that. Porzingis had 28 and 12. Dallas goes to 30, keeps moving up the standings. San Antonio goes to 8 games, maybe even 9 games below 500. And that's what gets so interesting here, is that the Spurs are dropping out 9 games under 500. Spurs 9 games under 500. Portland without Damian Lillard. So as much as Memphis is struggling, it's as though there's only one team left, and that's Zion and the Pelicans to make that run. We'll talk about it when we continue with Ben Golliver here on a Thursday edition of Locked On NBA. Locked On NBA did a power poll this week and then also asked, what is the most exciting team to play to all of our hosts? And the Pelicans won. The Pelicans won the poll for the team most enjoyable to watch. I mean, I frankly stopped and watched Zion Lakers the other night. I mean, truly, like, stopped and watched, not just in the background going on. He has become must-see TV.
There's no question about it. I mean, you should have seen the scene before the game where he's going through his warm-ups, and they've got 50 cameras and camera phones out there watching him just go through, like, light layup drills. I mean, that's the level of phenomenon we've reached. You know, do you remember the head-to-head game he had against Giannis where he ripped the ball out of Giannis's hands? And you know, Giannis won that matchup pretty handily when the Pelicans played the Bucks before the All-Star break. But it was just sort of a sign of Zion's fearlessness. Like, he wasn't afraid. That really jumped off the page or jumped out of that game to me at Staples Center the other night, because I think so many people get caught up in playing LeBron James and sharing the court with him of almost, you know, it's kind of a surreal moment the first time you're doing that. So many of these guys, especially his age, have been watching LeBron for practically their entire lives, right? Like, LeBron's in year 17 of playing in the NBA, and Zion's in year 19 of being alive, right? So I was kind of expecting him to do some double takes or maybe to come out hesitant or whatever. That wasn't the case at all. I mean, he was, you know, doing everything he always does, moving well in the half-court offense, getting the ball on the move, you know, hard spinning on guys who just can't handle him. At one point, he drew two fouls back-to-back in pretty quick succession from Dwight Howard, and he mouthed to one of his teammates every time, just basically like, feed me the ball, this guy can't guard me. I mean, that level of confidence is great. I don't think it borders on cockiness. I don't think it goes too far, but I think that he just is very comfortable in what he can do, and it's nice to see that he's comfortable with his body as well. The other interesting thing with LeBron, though, after the game was, you know, LeBron revealed that these two guys have never met. They've never had a conversation. And Zion was getting pretty tired of the LA media kind of fishing for compliments on LeBron's behalf. And I think it goes back to the kind of his fearlessness and his, you know, his feeling that he belongs already. He's not a typical rookie. I think he's coming in with this just self-assuredness and, you know, almost like a mental calm to him where he doesn't get, you know, fazed by all the attention. He doesn't buy into the hype. He doesn't care so much about the one-on-one matchups or anything like that. He goes out there and plays basketball, and he plays hard, he plays the right way, and he punishes people regularly with his athleticism, his versatility. So, I mean, all of those things are reasons to tune in every single night. And if our listeners aren't, I don't know what's wrong with them, Locke. They need to be watching this guy all the time.
Here's the one that stunned me. I thought he'd be great when he came back and, you know, do all the offensive stuff. He's so powerful. He's so explosive. I love how hard he plays. I thought he'd be an unmitigated disaster defensively. And I thought they would be negative every night with him on the floor. And that's not happened at all.
Yeah, well, when they go small, I still don't love it. I still can see some of the questions that you had defensively because he's not the world's longest guy. You know, his quick jumping ability on the offensive end makes a much bigger difference and impact than it does on the defensive end. And when he's trying to come over and help, I don't feel like, especially against a team as long as the Lakers, I don't feel like he has that big-time impact around the rim like you're kind of hoping for. Now, maybe some awareness improvement will help. The fact that he can step out and guard a variety of different people, that is definitely helpful. You know, in switches, you're not getting, you know, super worried that he's going to get blown by and all that kind of stuff. So I do think that he's still a work in progress defensively, but the impact stuff is out of control. I mean, this is why I was kind of arguing last week that he could even sneak back into this Rookie of the Year conversation, because I saw him and John back-to-back nights. Ja is a good player right now. You can even argue that he's a very good player. I mean, Zion is already a great player making big impacts every single night. I mean, obviously, he's been lapped three times by how many games he missed, and Ja Morant's got the big lead. But if the Pelicans push back into the playoff picture, if he continues to have this just gigantic plus-minus where they're winning the minutes when he's on the court, and he's continuing to average, like, you know, 20 and 8 or whatever it would be over the last 10 games, that's pretty compelling evidence that this guy is the best rookie out there. And maybe he didn't have the best season. I understand that. But I think there's a real gap in talent and impact between him and everybody else in his class.
How good do you think New Orleans is?
I think they're good. I mean, I think if they're in the 1-8 against the Lakers, it's just gigantic ratings and the series is over in 4 or 5 games. I think that their fatal flaw is matchups. I mean, you saw LeBron just bullying Drew Holiday for 40 points. I don't think that New Orleans has a great defensive answer for Anthony Davis either. And I think that the inexperienced stuff would show through. But they would make it fun. They would be very entertaining. And I think I would pick them over any of those teams that you mentioned in terms of making the playoffs right now. I mean, I was expecting Memphis to probably go like 1-3 on that road trip. They went 0-4, and honestly, at times looked even worse than that. So I think that they're in, they're in almost like a crisis mode right now in terms of falling out of that spot. And when you're looking at the teams that are really kind of chasing them, who's developing real, true, positive momentum? It's not the Spurs and it's not the Blazers. So I actually kind of think the computers are going to get proven right here. I mean, the computers were all over the Pelicans because of the strength of schedule stuff, even going back to, you know, the trade deadline or when Zion first came back to the court. I think they're going to be proven right here.
Quick questions for you, wrapping up with Ben Golliver. The Charlotte Hornets beat the Knicks 107-101. RJ Barrett, 2 of 11 tonight. Have you seen enough of him to have an opinion?
Yeah, I'm not a big fan. I mean, I don't want to write him off after his rookie season, but I have not seen very much positive or helpful from him. I think that, defensively, it's very tough to judge anybody there, but he's not helping. I think that he's got blinders when he goes to the basket. I don't think that he has really, truly internalized how to create a good shot and take a good shot. In other words, how to resist bad shots. I think that he loves going downhill and, flipping up stuff, in the basket area that just doesn't have a great chance of going in. He can improve in terms of taking contact and getting himself to the free throw line. I don't think he's the world's best shooter. And I guess he revealed this week that he's actually shooting with the wrong hand because he's really right-handed, which is all news to me. I'm not saying he's a bust and you throw him away yet at all. But, when I look at the Knicks season, it was a completely lost year for a million reasons. But the lack of, true hope and development from RJ Barrett has got to be right at the top of the list.
Markieff Morris and Reggie Jackson changed the Clippers how much?
Somewhat, not a ton. I mean, Reggie Jackson needs to get into shape, and I don't want to, sit on this podcast and call him out recklessly, but he looked heavy and sluggish to me when I saw him the other night. Obviously, he's dealt with some injury issues this year, so I think that he needs to, recommit there. I mean, the clock is ticking. They basically got 6 weeks until the playoffs, so I would, want to see that from him before I start to sing his praises. I do think Morris is a great fit and an upgrade, and when you're looking at that Houston matchup like we were talking about earlier, I think he's a guy who can mostly get by if you're switching everything, right? I think he's a pretty clean fit in that spot. Now, whether he's going to be part of their closing lineup, I would guess not. But that's okay because I think their closing lineup is really, really good. Personally for me, I would be closing with Beverly, Shamit, Paul George, Kawhi Leonard, and Montrezl Harrell. Whether I was playing against the Rockets or basically everyone else, I think that gives you a combination of a bunch of shooting, completely interchangeable 1-5 on everybody on the court. It takes Lou Williams off, so you don't have someone who you can really pick on defensively. And I think it gives you multiple high-level creators in Paul George and Kawhi Leonard. I think that's an awesome group. It hasn't gotten a real chance to play together this year because of injury issues. But to me, I think that's probably the most impressive closing lineup in the league right now, depending on who your favorite five is for Milwaukee.
He's Ben Golliver, Washington Post. I'm David Locke. This has been the Thursday edition of Locked On NBA. Tomorrow, Anthony and Adam will have Locked On NBA for you. But right now, since we've wrapped up, time to tell your smart device to play the most recent episode of podcast, Rejecting the Screen. Have a good night, or day, or afternoon.